guided Jefferson's thinking about North America. For the immediate future, he was determined to get control of New Orleans for the United States so as to prevent the West from breaking away from the United States. Beyond that, he sought an all-water route through the unexplored western two-thirds of the continent. When Robert Gray sailed Columbia into the estuary of the river he named for his ship and fixed its latitude and longitude, mankind knew for the first time how far the continent extended. Knowing the exact location of the mouth of the Columbia represented a great triumph of 18th-century science and exploration. Most closely associated with England's Captain James Cook, the second great age of discovery had used the sextant and other navigational devices to delineate the continents and the seacoasts of the world, the great harbors and the mouths of the great rivers, with precision on the map, and with descriptions of the landforms and native people. What remained to be discovered on Earth was the interior of Africa, Australia, the Arctic and Antarctic, and the western two-thirds of North America. The latter was most important to Europeans and Americans. It was known to be vast, some 2,000 miles from the Mississippi River to the mouth of the Columbia. It was known to contain a wealth of furs. It was presumed to contain immense quantities of coal, salt, iron, gold, and silver. It was assumed that the soil and rainfall conditions were similar to those in Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee, which is to say, ideal for agriculture. But what was not known, or what was assumed but was badly wrong, was more important than what was known. Donald Jackson, the great Lewis and Clark scholar, points out that although Jefferson had the most extensive library in the world on the geography, cartography, natural history, and ethnology of that awesome terra incognita west of the Mississippi, when he took the oath of office in 1801, he believed these things: that the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia might be the highest on the continent, that the mammoth, the giant ground sloth, and other prehistoric creatures would be found along the upper Missouri, that a mountain of pure salt a mile long lay somewhere on the Great Plains, that volcanoes might still be erupting in the badlands of the upper Missouri, that all the great rivers of the West, the Missouri, Columbia, Colorado, and Rio Grande, rose from a single height of land and flowed off in their several directions to the seas of the hemisphere. Most important, he believed there might be a water connection, linked by a low portage across the mountains, that would lead to the Pacific. Louisiana in 1801, that part of North America lying between the Mississippi River and the Rocky Mountains, was up for grabs. The contestants were the British coming out of Canada, the Spanish coming up from Texas and California, the French coming up the Mississippi-Missouri from New Orleans, the Russians coming down from the Northwest, and the Americans coming from the East. And, of course, there were already inhabitants who possessed the land and were determined to hold on to it. There were scores of Indian tribes living across Louisiana, but given their lack of effective political organization, their inability to combine forces into an alliance, their utter dependence on whites for rifles, and the experience of Americans east of the Appalachians in the 17th and 18th centuries, and in Kentucky and Ohio in the 1790s, it could be taken for granted that the conquest of the Indian tribes would be bloody, costly, time-consuming, but certain. Jefferson's attitude toward Indians was the exact opposite of his attitude toward Negroes. He thought of Indians as noble savages who could be civilized and brought into the body politic as full citizens. In 1785, he wrote, "I believe the Indian then to be in body and mind equal to the white man." He thought the only difference between Indians and white men was religion and the savage behavior of the Indians, which was caused by the environment in which the Indian lived. Never did he say that the perceived shortcomings of the Negro, such as laziness or thievery, were caused by their condition as slaves. Keenly interested in Indian ethnology, an avid collector of Indian vocabularies, he had not the slightest interest in African ethnology or African vocabularies. When Jefferson or young Virginians like Lewis and Clark looked at an Indian, they saw a noble savage ready to be transformed into a civilized citizen. When they looked at a Negro, they saw something less than a human, something more than an animal. Never in their lives did they imagine the possibility of a black man's becoming a full citizen. William Clark tried to adopt a part Indian boy as his own son. He would not have dreamed of adopting a black boy as his own son. Spain claimed to own Louisiana, which was roughly defined as that part of the interior of the continent drained by the Missouri River and the southwestern tributaries of the Mississippi River. But, except for a handful of weak garrisons scattered along the Mississippi and anchored by New Orleans in the south and St. Louis in the north, Spain had no effective force in the empire. The British had fur trading interests in Upper Louisiana and a claim of sorts to the Oregon country west of the Rockies. The Russians had interests in the area around and north of the mouth of the Columbia. The Spanish had some vague claims to the entire Pacific coast. The French, who had once owned Louisiana and whose people, French Canadians, were the only white men to have much experience in Louisiana, were considering reasserting their position. But European ambitions for the inland empire were more theoretical than real, partly because the chief concerns of the contestants were their wars with one another within Europe, even more because of time and distance, mountains and rivers. In 1801, the European nations were no more capable of exploring, conquering, settling, and exploiting the western two-thirds of North America than they had been in the preceding three centuries. Nor was the United States, not immediately anyway, but Mr. Jefferson's America had two great advantages over its European rivals. First, citizens of the United States were crossing the Appalachians and settling in the Ohio country, right up to the eastern bank of the Mississippi. Indeed, a handful of Americans had already crossed the Mississippi to settle, most of them illegally, in Upper Louisiana. Americans, in short, were beginning to take physical possession of lands to which the Europeans had only claims or hopes. The second great advantage was that the United States had Thomas Jefferson for its leader. But on the day of Jefferson's inaugural, frontiersmen west of the mountains could move their bulky agricultural products to market only by river, which meant via the Ohio-Mississippi route. That economic fact dictated politics. The Americans of the West would join Spain, France, or Britain, or whoever controlled New Orleans, or create their own nation and take New Orleans for themselves. Vice President Aaron Burr was full of plots and schemes and conspiracies to break the West loose from the United States and form a new nation. Jefferson would have none of it. He believed in what he called an empire of liberty. Our Confederacy must be viewed as the nest from which all America, North or South, is to be peopled, he wrote even before the Constitution was adopted, and as president he said that he awaited with impatience the day when the continent would be settled by a people speaking the same language, governed in similar forms, and by similar laws. In an age of imperialism, he was the greatest empire builder of all. His mind encompassed the continent. From the beginning of the Revolution, he thought of the United States as a nation stretching from sea to sea. More than any other man, he made that happen. His motives were many. He sought greatness for himself and for his nation. He rejected the thought of North America's being divided up into nation-states on the European model. He wanted the principles of the American Revolution spread over the continent, shared equally by all. He was one of the principal authors of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, as revolutionary a document as his Declaration of Independence. The ordinance provided for the admission into the Union of from 3 to 5 states from the territory east of the Mississippi and north of the Ohio, when the territories had a large enough population. These states would be fully equal to the original 13. Thanks to Thomas Jefferson, the United States would be an empire without colonies, an empire of equals. The ordinance helped bind the trans-Appalachian region to the United States. What mountains and rivers threatened to drive asunder, Jefferson helped to overcome through a political act. But it was not just the largeness of his mind that made Jefferson an imperialist. One of his basic motives was land hunger. Jefferson and his fellow Virginia planters made their living through tobacco and slavery, and tobacco and slavery demanded the unending acquisition of new land. Jefferson's actions as wartime governor of Virginia showed more clearly than anything else the centrality of Western lands to his politics. He was elected governor in 1779. The next year, the British invaded the Carolinas. Virginia was in no position to aid its beleaguered neighbor states to the south because Jefferson had invested Virginia's military resources in George Rogers Clark's campaign to conquer British outposts in the region north of the Ohio River. Jefferson's passion to take full possession of western lands almost cost the United States their independence. As a politician, Jefferson was keenly sensitive to the needs and dreams of his constituents. In Virginia, his supporters were small farmers, men who, after the Revolution, were apprehensive about the obvious trend to ever larger plantations tilled by slave labor. They looked to the West for new and cheaper lands, especially in the rich virgin soil beyond the mountains. There, they could raise bumper crops that could be sent quickly to the world market via the fabulous river system of the Ohio-Mississippi. While the Northwest territories were being settled, in Jefferson's view, the Trans-Mississippi Western Empire could serve as a vast reservation for Indians displaced from east of the river. There, they could learn to farm and become civilized so that they could be incorporated into the body politic. Eventually, Louisiana would be available for farmers emigrating from the east or immigrating from Europe. There was land enough for all in a United States stretching from sea to sea, land enough to sustain the American dream for centuries to come. Henry Adams wrote, "Jefferson aspired beyond the ambition of a nationality and embraced in his view the whole future of man. He wished to bring a new era. In 1801, he set himself to the task of governing with a golden age in view." The Spanish might have title to Louisiana, the French might have interests in Louisiana, the British might have designs on Louisiana, the Spanish and French and Russians and British might be contemplating exercising vague titles to or otherwise meddling in Oregon, but in Jefferson's mind it would all be part of the United States in due course. Most of his countrymen agreed with him. Like him, they thought big. Henry Adams described the American of 1801 in these words: "Stripped for the hardest work, every muscle firm and elastic, every ounce of brain ready for use, and not a trace of superfluous flesh on his nervous and supple body, the American stood in the world a new order of man." Adams was generalizing, but he could have been describing Meriwether Lewis. Chapter 5. The President's Secretary, 1801 to 1802. On February 23, 1801, 11 days before his inauguration, President-elect Jefferson wrote Captain Lewis. He said he needed a secretary, not only to aid in the private concerns of the household, but also to contribute to the mass of information which it is interesting for the administration to acquire. "Your knowledge of the Western country, of the army, and of all its interests and relations has rendered it desirable that you should be engaged in that office." The salary would be only $500 per year, scarcely more than the pay and rations that Lewis would have to relinquish, although Jefferson assured him that he would retain his rank and his right to promotion. Further, service as the President's secretary would make you know and be known to characters of influence in the affairs of our country and give you the advantage of their wisdom. He would live in the President's house as you would be one of my family. Jefferson wrote a job description. "The office is more in the nature of that of an aide-de-camp than a mere secretary. The writing is not considerable because I write my own letters and copy them in a press. The care of our company, execution of some commissions in the town occasionally, messages to Congress, occasional conferences and explanations with particular members, with the offices and inhabitants of the place where it cannot so well be done in writing, constitute the chief business." The President's secretary would be paid from the President's private funds and provided with a servant and a horse, also at the President's expense. "The post has been solicited by several who will have no answer till I hear from you." He requested an immediate reply. It took almost 2 weeks for Jefferson's letter to reach Lewis in Pittsburgh. On March 7th, Lewis expressed his joy in a letter to his company commander, tent mate and fellow Virginian, Captain Ferdinand Claiborne. "I cannot withhold from you, my friend, the agreeable intelligence I received on my arrival at this place, Pittsburgh, by way of a very polite note from Thomas Jefferson, the newly elected President of the United States, signifying his wish that I should accept the office of his private secretary, This unbounded as well as unexpected confidence, conferred on me by a man whose virtue and talents I have ever adored, and always conceived second to none, I must confess did not fail to raise me somewhat in my own estimation, insomuch that I have almost prevailed on myself to believe that my abilities are equal to the task. However, be that as it may, I am resolved to accept it, and shall therefore set forward to the city of Washington in a few days. I deem the prospect too flattering to be neglected by a man of my standing and prospects in life. He closed the euphoric letter with a hint of his instinct for politics, along with the air of self-importance that went with being the president's secretary. I shall take the liberty of informing you of the most important political occurrences of our government, or such of them as I may feel myself at liberty to give. The maddening delays and infrequency of the mails forced the eager young man to wait 3 days before he could post his reply to Jefferson. In a letter dated March 10th, Lewis explained, "Not until too late on Friday last to answer by that day's mail did I receive yours of the 23rd ult, asking that I accept the place of your private secretary." He immediately got to the point. "I most cordially acquiesce, and with pleasure accept the office." After profuse thanks for the honor, Lewis promised to get forward to the city of Washington with all possible dispatch. "Rest assured, I shall not relax in my exertions. Receive, I pray you, sir, the most undissembled assurance of the attachment and friendship of your most obedient and very humble servant, Meriwether Lewis." He set off at once, but spring rains, a lame horse, and miserable roads conspired to slow his progress. It took him 3 weeks to get from Pittsburgh to Washington, where he arrived on the afternoon of April 1st. Shortly thereafter, he wrote his friend Thornton Gilmer of Albemarle, "I feel my situation in the president's family an extremely pleasant one. I very little expected that I possessed the confidence of Mr. J. in so far as to have produced on his part a voluntary offer of the office of his private secretary. However, nothing is extraordinary in these days of revolution and reform." He was active in reform. Jefferson had a specific mission in mind when he offered the post to Lewis, who became a key participant in one of the president's most important projects, one of the planks in his election campaign: reducing the size of the army. In a letter of February 23, 1801, to General James Wilkinson, commanding general of the army, asking Wilkinson to release Captain Lewis from active service while allowing him to retain his rank and right to promotion, Jefferson had explained that he had chosen Lewis on the basis of a personal acquaintance with him, owing from his being of my neighborhood. But the president had something more specific in mind. He knew Lewis not only as a neighbor, but as a solid Republican and as an army officer who, because of his responsibilities as paymaster, had traveled extensively throughout the Trans-Appalachian region, visiting the various army posts, and thus a man who knew the officer corps well. Jefferson's somewhat cryptic reference to Lewis's knowledge of the Western country, of the army, and of all its interests and relations was a reference not to an upcoming exploration of the Missouri River country, but to politics. What Jefferson wanted first of all from Lewis was help in reducing the grip of the Federalists on the Army Officer Corps. Jefferson intended to reduce the size of the army by one half. This was good Republican principle and sound policy. The undeclared war with France was over, and relations with the British were quiet. Money could be saved by the government, also solid Republican principle, if the number of officers was cut back, something that made sense in any event because of the way John Adams and the Federalists had swelled the ranks of the officer corps during the war scare of 1798, and again through Adams's midnight appointments in March 1801. If officers were going to be cut, Jefferson figured it should be done, at least to some extent, on the same basis according to which they had been given their commissions: partisan politics. But Jefferson had never worn a uniform. He did not know even the senior, much less the junior, officers in the army. He did not know which officers were competent, which were extreme Federalists, which were inferior, which superior. But his young friend Meriwether Lewis knew, and Jefferson could count on him to evaluate the officer corps with complete candor. Thus, Lewis's first task as Jefferson's secretary was to go through a roster from the War Department listing all commissioned officers. Using a simple code of symbols, plus sign, plus sign, plus sign, or 00, or pound sign, etc., Lewis passed a judgment on every officer in the army. There were 11 symbols in all. The first, denote such officers as are of the first class, so esteemed from a superiority of genius and military proficiency. The second showed officers of the second class, respectable. The third listed the same, Republican. The fourth covered officers whose politics Lewis could not positively ascertain. Fifth, officers without politics. Sixth, those opposed to the administration, otherwise respectable. Seventh, more decisively opposed to the administration. Eighth, most violently opposed to the administration and still active in its vilification. Ninth, professional soldiers without a political creed. 10th, unworthy of the commissions they bear. Finally, unknown to us. Jefferson did not take a meat axe to the Federalists on Lewis's list. If one puts the list beside the names of the officers dismissed from the service, it is clear that in the winnowing process, military qualifications were given much greater consideration than party preference. Federalist officers rated superior by Lewis retained their commissions. Of those rated acceptable, 7 of 18 were retained. This was good politics as well as good military policy. Jefferson wanted to bring the country together, not make it more divided than it already was, and of course he hoped to win over at least some Federalists to his cause, so he had to keep some Federalists in the army. But all except one of those noted as most violently opposed to the administration were dropped.